Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Practically everyone now thinks of our Earth as the blue planet covered mostly by water. But we may forget that the health of the oceans affects us directly. Our guest doesn't forget. He is Carl Cifina, founder of the Living Oceans Program at the Audubon Society. An ecologist, Dr. Cifina has been awarded prestigious awards both for his science and for his writing for general audiences. He now has drawn on both of his gifts and enlisted the services of the ocean's legendary albatrosses. Dr. Cifina brings back stories of the profound impact humans are having on the high seas. He has startling revelations of how directly that is tied to those of us who live on the land. Dr. Cifina's vivid example comes from fellow scientists who were studying pollution in the American heartland.
Those scientists went to the islands in the North Pacific to compare the polluted Great Lakes birds to the pristine albatrosses of the North Pacific, and they found very similar levels of pesticides in birds that they thought were going to be their remote comparison. And that was very startling to those scientists and, you know, sort of an awful surprise.
Carl Cifina founded the Living Oceans Program at the Audubon Society. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Award for his work on behalf of the oceans and their life forms. He won the prestigious Lannan Prize for his book, Song for the Blue Ocean. With a PhD in ecology, Dr. Cifina is also affiliated with the Environmental Studies Program at Yale. Now, Carl Cifina has written Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. Bill Russell and I are enthusiastic about both hope and survival, so we welcomed Carl back to our program for a chance to consider both.
Carl Cifina, in my bedroom, I have a great big map. It is a map of the world. And when the map first went up, I looked at the land masses. And then I read your book, Song for the Blue Ocean, and I started looking at the ocean part that you reminded me covers 3/4 of the planet. But now you have me looking at the air above the oceans. Why should I look at the air above the oceans when there's all of this landmass and sea mass that I could be looking at?
I'm a little surprised that it came across to you that way.
Because, well, you filled up the skies, Carl.
I suppose I did, but it's the skies right above the ocean with all the things that are utterly dependent on the ocean. And it was just another way of filling in those big blue spaces that most people think are blank, and they're not blank.
Well, that which I began to be able to see under the sea by virtue of your first book, A Song for the Blue Ocean, was busy, it was big, and then there were deserts, and there was a lot going on, and I was at least as surprised that there's a lot going on in the skies too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did you go looking for them, or did the skies call you?
Well, as in, actually in both books, I wrote about things that I have been involved in for a long time. I just cast the net a little wider.
As it were. Spoken as a true fisherman.
Exactly. The first book had a lot to do with fish and fisheries, which I've been involved in since I was 3 years old. And I have done a lot of work with seabirds.
Like a PhD.
All through graduate school, I studied seabirds. I got my PhD and my master's degree studying seabirds. I've watched seabirds while I was fishing and watched for them as a way of finding the fish ever since I was, about 12 years old and started fishing on the open ocean. So this was just a way of writing about the bigger world of things that had filled up my personal world for a long time. I didn't quite go looking. I just went expanding a little bit.
I think about, going back to Paula's map, there was a time in, I guess, the 14th century when the maps had local things, and then there were sea monsters out around the edges of
incognito.
Terra incognito. And in that context, in some ways, an awful lot of what you describe is still that. We have the surface that is there, and it's blue on the map, But what's underneath that surface still, I think, in a lot of cases, striking number of cases, is just appears to be a mystery. And then the air above it, there are no humans there, so we don't think that we know very much about it, and do not, in fact, though we do have, we've developed sensing devices that have sort of changed the equation. But there's still an awful lot of mare incognito, isn't there?
For most people, that's true. I mean, the oceans are home to millions and millions and millions and millions of seabirds, and on tuna vessels, they have bird radar. They have radar that is specifically tuned to find birds. So their
it's
world...
It's not because they're bird watchers.
It's not because they're ornithologists.
No, it's for the reason that I alluded to earlier, that the birds find the fish and they help bring the tuna fishermen to where the tuna are that way.
Even these are commercial fishers?
The very biggest, yes.
So all this sophisticated stuff is so they can find the birds to know where the fish are?
Exactly.
Because the birds are better at it than anything we can come up with.
Their world is loaded with birds, and their focus is very much on finding where the birds are, because the birds have found where those patches of life in the sea are, and then they take their very, very gigantic fishing boats, and they go and try to catch up as much of it as they can.
You talk about the birds live on the ocean. I mean, you said that's kind of passed on through, but you really mean that? The birds live on the ocean rather than living on the land and then going for it. It is astonishing to me, the stories that you tell about how specifically they live on the ocean and how many thousands of miles they fly.
Right, and many seabirds are only sort of chained to the land for breeding and would never come to land for resting. Some of them don't even come to the water for resting. They fly continuously, although very, very few fly continuously. Almost all of them rest on the sea, but many of them take a number of years to reach maturity. And before they breed and until they breed, they have no reason to return to land, and they never return to land. And their world is the ocean just as much as your world is the land.
This is Carl Safina. We're going to be back with him in just a moment. Because I am so boggled by this, we're going to talk some more specifically about that. Bill Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return.